Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi. Welcome back. This is the MedTech Talk podcast. I hope you'll be joining us at the MedTech Conference on May 31st. Go to medtechconference.com to check out the agenda. One of the high points, I think, will be Fred Moll, the robotics pioneer, will be there to speak about the future of MedTech. And clearly, robotics is a space that has hit its stride. And our guest today, Todd Pope, the president and CEO of Transenteric, certainly knows a great deal about that. Todd joined Transenteric in 2008 to lead the company's development of the Spyder surgical system, a single port surgical system. Did that successfully. But Todd and company executives realized that robotics was the future. And Transenteric faced the choice of partnering with someone in the robotic space or building their own system. And they chose the latter course. It's been a interesting 10 years. It's been one that has had a lot of ups and some downs as well. And Todd will get into that into this conversation. But it's involved a lot of salesmanship and a lot of leadership. So I think this is a great conversation for anyone who wants to understand the trials and tribulations and triumphs of leading a medtech startup. Todd was very honest, and I appreciated his time and his frankness. And I hope you learn a lot from the conversation. And of course, I also hope you'll join us at the MedTech Conference on May 31st. You can go to medtechconference.com to register. Our numbers are strong, but we would love to have you there in person. Now let's get into this conversation with Todd Pope of Transenteric. Well, Todd Pope, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom.
So if anything has proven that you're a patient man, and we're going to get into the Transenteric story in a bit, and I think that's going to demonstrate your patience and your dedication as well, but just getting this podcast recorded has required great patience on your part with some technical snafus on my part, so I appreciate your understanding.
Yeah, I'm glad to join you today.
So let's get into the story. I always like to start off just understanding a little bit more about our guests and their origins. What led you to a career in medtech?
You know, coming through college, I started off like many people in pre-med, and I really had eyes on being a surgeon. Going into it, I just don't think I had the stick-to-itiveness to, you know, 8, 10, 12 years, you know, post-undergraduate without being in the operating room. I knew a few folks that were ahead of me that got into medical device sales. They were able to get great training and be in the operating room, you know, shortly after graduation, working with surgeons in the OR with products that were implantable. And that really got my eyes set on a career in medical device quite early.
Interesting. What is that experience like? I've never been in the operating room, and I know that's a common place for a lot of people listening to this podcast. But as a observer, as someone who's probably been in a lot of surgeries, what is that experience like from someone who's not performing the surgery, but you are providing some service?
Well, I think it's a real honor to be able to be in the operating room. Most device personnel do not make it in the OR. It's really only for folks that can provide a service that's, you know, important and relevant enough to require you to be in scrubs in the OR. And typically the easiest way I describe it, even though people are sometimes taken aback that industry's in there, most surgeons only operate 1 or 2 days a week. You know, we as reps and managers, we saw surgery with our product every day, day in and day out. So within a year of being in the field, you've probably seen your product being operated with, you know, 10 or 20 times more than that surgeon. So we brought a lot of experience, and I think it's humbling. You really feel the responsibility when you're in there to make sure that everything has your complete focus, attention, and you're providing value. So I love it. It's hard not to be excited when you wake up and know you're going to be in the operating room. It's just it's important things going on in there, to say the least.
And that is something that has come under has been challenged lately with looking for ways to lower costs of healthcare. I know the getting the sales reps out of the surgery has been something that someone have identified as an area where we can find some savings. Do you see things that way, or do you see that that role being too critical to remove from the process?
I think it's very product and procedure specific. I think the healthcare industry's done a nice job of weeding all non-essential personnel out of the operating room. I don't think people need to be in there unless they're providing a service or education that can be important that day. And so I've seen, you know, I started in the late 80s, right out of college, so I've been in it right at 30 years, and I've seen a real culling of people out of the OR, and I think it's appropriate. Not many people are in the OR that are industry anymore unless they really can provide a value or service that's going to give better odds of that surgery going well.
So your career took you to Boston Scientific and then J&J, where you were the global president of Cordis. How did your path take you through Boston Scientific and then J&J? What were some of your stops along the way?
Yeah, well, you know, actually my first job in medtech was Johnson & Johnson. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, laparoscopic surgery was just taking off. And Ethicon Endosurgery was just breaking off from Ethicon Incorporated at J&J. And so I was in that first sales class at Ethicon Endosurgery. We were really trying to join U.S. Surgical that was in the market with laparoscopic surgery, trocars, staplers. And it was an exciting time. There was a lot of innovation. There was a lot of growth of minimally invasive surgery. So I was fortunate enough to get into it in a real updraft. A lot of innovation was being brought into the OR, and we were there working on both the innovation and training side. So I kind of went through sales and marketing at J&J and had a really good run there. And then I got recruited over, as you said, to Boston Scientific. And at Boston Scientific, it was still minimally invasive surgery. It was just more catheter-based. We were doing a lot with peripheral arterial disease and then coronary disease. And then I eventually moved along with the technology into neurovascular, where we were able to take catheter-based technology and go all the way up to the carotids and then even into the brain to deal with stroke, both hemorrhagic stroke and ischemic stroke. So my whole career has really been around minimally invasive surgery.
And what was it that brought you back to Johnson & Johnson?
Well, I was at Boston Scientific. I was involved with the neurovascular business, kind of a global sales and marketing leadership role there. And Cordis was being, Guidant was being folded into Cordis. That was the plan. You know, J&J was going to acquire Guidant. And then Boston Scientific actually came in with the help of Abbott and others. And that's a well-told story. And I ended up acquiring Guidant. So Johnson & Johnson had planned on bringing Guidant in, so some of their R&D had been on pause, and some of their commercial plans had been on pause because they were going to fold in a very successful Guidant company. So at that time, J&J was looking to reinvigorate their own internal R&D and their commercial efforts, and they were going to bring in a leader for Cordis. And that business really had three divisions. They had endovascular, you know, cardiology or coronary vasculature, and then neurovascular. And so I was able to move over there. I had a lot of catheter-based experience from Boston Scientific. It was a big job, and it was certainly a challenge because they had really planned on bringing over the Guidant franchise. So it was exciting to go in there. Drug-eluting stents were growing by leaps and bounds at that time, and technology was, again, pushing the envelope. So it was a great opportunity to go over to J&J at that time.
Terrific. And along this way, did you always nurse the idea of being at a startup, of leaving big companies for small?
Yeah, I continued to try to build entrepreneurial spirit, you know, within the big companies. It's sometimes hard. We had several initiatives to break off some of our development activities and let them have kind of a small board and a lot of autonomy. And I saw a lot of success when we did that at the big company. So it really whet my appetite to do a startup, to really go back into a field that needed some innovation and start from the beginning. But when you find yourself running in one of the larger divisions at J&J, it's sometimes harder at that point to step all the way back and start over as employee one. But I always felt like if I found the technology that was appealing enough that I would do it, and that's what happened with Transenterix.
Well, let's talk a bit about that that decision process. How were you contacted? How did you become aware of the opportunity, and what was your thought process? How difficult was it to leave the larger company to become CEO of a startup?
Sure. Well, the way I came about finding out about transenterics is Dr. Richard Stack. He's a very well-known cardiologist, extremely innovative at Duke University. He has a never-ending well of ideas, and he saw that single-port surgery was becoming very popular in general surgery. And even though he's a cardiologist, he thought you could take catheter-based technologies and really create a better single-port surgery device. And he had a business partner, Bill Starling, and the two of those gentlemen had started quite a few companies, and they had an idea to start transenterics. And they actually came to me to run it by me when I was at Cordis and said, would Cordis be interested in this idea? And it really was a general surgery application, and we were all intravascular at Cordis. So it planted the seed, and then they were going to be in North Carolina founding the company. That's where I was originally from and my family. And it was an opportunity to go and find out a little bit more about the company, their, at least their idea. And I just decided that that's exactly what I wanted to do. It was not easy, to your question. I had worked very hard to be at the role that I was enjoying at J&J, and they're a great company, and I was enjoying the challenge. But thinking about starting something from scratch, I felt like minimally invasive surgery was going to do two things. It was going to leverage, you know, my last 15 or 20 years. So I think I was going to be well prepared to bring value there. And then I thought it had a great growth opportunity ahead of it. So those two things, you know, kind of tipped me over the balance. And I said, that's what I'm going to do.
That's fantastic. So, and it's been a very interesting ride, and you've done a lot for a startup, and just compiling the timeline. I feel like, you know, I've had Johnny Cash's "I've Been Everywhere" man in my song in my head, because you've done everything that you really need to do as a startup. You went public, you've raised capital, you've had some experiences with the FDA. We're going to get into all of that, but let's start right off at the start with the Series A financing. And we don't need to go through every single item, but I'm just curious. You were raising money. You raised $20 million for a Series A in January 2008. That was just when things were starting to soften under MedTech once again. What was that process like, and how did things sort of play out after you raised this capital and you were funded, and then things in MedTech started to sort of fall around you, or at least fall around everyone, not you specifically?
Well, you're right. That your setup is exactly accurate of the environment back then. You know, my thought, since we had invested in a lot of small companies when I was running Cordis, I saw that one of the big issues with young companies is they typically don't raise enough money to where they can really put their head down and work. They seem to always be in fundraising mode. So we had an idea that we wanted to do a big Series A, not to pat ourselves on the back and say, look how big our Series A was, but just so we could get off the fundraising trail and work. And so a $20 million A round, I don't know if it was the biggest A round back then, but it was certainly one of the biggest A rounds that, you know, you'll see in a med tech. It was led by SD Life Sciences. I think they were very entrepreneurial and believed. I had some experience with the folks over at SD Life Sciences because they had previously been at Boston Scientific with me, so there was some familiarity. And we were off and running. You know, we had an idea for a single port product called the Spider. We got the appropriate funding, and it really allowed us to put her head down and go to work, not just incrementally try to get by every month. You know, we went ahead and applied a lot of resources and moved fast. We built prototypes. We did preclinical models. We got a great scientific advisory board from surgeons, and we moved quickly to have a product that was ready to file with the FDA. So I think that was something that was a little different, that I think my perspective at a big company, seeing some of these small companies maybe not move as fast as they wanted, that really shaped our early experience.
And what was the development process like for your products? You said you started with Spider, but Surgibot was your sort of primary product for a time. Was Spider in an early iterative form of Surgibot, or what's the connection?
It was. You know, Spider was a single port surgery product that really removed a lot of the trade-offs that surgeons were having to, you know, settle with other single port products. We had listened to a lot of surgeons. We did something a little different in our business. We actually, instead of outsourcing all of our part making, we actually built a high throughput prototype lab right in our building. We bought all the equipment, and we still have it today. We had lathes and mills, five-axis machines, laser welders, 3D printers. So we were able to be very innovative because we built every one of our parts, and we still do that 10 years later, a lot of it. So we built the Spider. We got FDA approval. We got CE mark approval. But we started to see the industry move toward more and more discussions were around robotics, were around bringing some technology into med tech instead of having everything be just a throwaway single-use item. And our device was a mechanical device, the Spider, and we thought it would lend itself very well to mechanization. So we made the move to take our single-use disposable Spider and create a surgical robot, and we called it the Surgibot. And that really shifted our strategy, our focus. You know, we were now going to be building a robotic platform, and we certainly didn't have all the key personnel and core competencies we needed. So we really had to shift the focus of the business, but we felt like we were shifting it, you know, toward where the market would go.
Mm-hmm. What I want to get into that decision in a moment, because that's a really obviously an important one, and I'm sure it was a fascinating decision, but or fascinating decision process. But going back to making everything in-house, what are the benefits of that, and would you do that again?
Yeah, for our particular device, it had some complexity. It wasn't just extruding a catheter or building, you know, a one-use device. We had quite a few different moving parts. So everything we were doing was very innovative. We weren't buying any products or parts off the shelf. So we figured if we had to order custom-made parts every time we wanted to make a change, it might take 6 or 8 weeks to order a dozen parts, and maybe half the time they would be right and half the time they'd be wrong. So what it allowed us to do is if we had an idea to make the product incrementally better, we could literally draw it up on CAD that morning in the R&D lab. We could actually build the parts that afternoon. We could assemble them that night, and we could put them in a lab the next morning. And it was just amazing how fast we could go, because so many times we thought a design would add incremental value. We actually built it, not on the computer, but we built it. We put it in surgeons' hands, and they're like, you know, I thought that was going to be better, but it actually has too much drag. This doesn't give me the right angle. I don't think the reach is here. I can't get all the way to the gallbladder. We need to make this, you know, longer. So just having that incredible, you know, fail fast and actually doing that through building products and putting them in surgeons' hands, I think that was a real game changer for us. And we still try to implement that. And to answer your question, yes, I would definitely do it again. Now, we were able to do that because we raised $20 million and we bought several million dollars worth of equipment and hired a lot of people out of automotive and aviation that were used to building a very unique part. So we definitely built an in-house kind of vertically integrated prototype mentality, and that was different than what most people do.
That's interesting. How did that affect the culture of the company? Bringing you've got, you know, there, I always think of it as being med tech people and then non med tech people, but you had a lot of non med tech people coming into a med tech.
We did have a lot of non med tech people. I think the first thing it did that was a positive, people knew that we had the ability to turn on a dime and we could be very responsive to customer feedback. Now, the negative was we were so nimble in doing that sometimes we had a hard time getting to design freeze because everybody had an idea to make it just a little bit better. And I ended up, and obviously it's totally in jest, but I ended up making a sign that said, you know, eventually we're going to have to shoot the engineers and launch the product, because we all of us had constant feedback on how to make it better. And since we were equipped to do that, you know, we really continued to pursue perfection a lot of times. And I think eventually we had to say, look, we might be able to make it incrementally better, but we need to get this product out on the market, you know? And so we had to fight that a little bit, but I would call that a high class problem.
And did the auto people, the folks you had in house, were they looking for that sort of, okay, you know, we got to get this thing out the door sort of thing, or were they accustomed to tweaking here and there? Where did the strive for perfection come from?
It's a really good question. We actually hired folks from automotive and aviation that were not in their manufacturing, but more in their prototype side. So they're used to being very creative. we just had a combination of a lot of young, talented engineers in R&D, a lot of very talented people in the prototype shop, and then surgeons that were very inquisitive that had never had a company that could actually take their ideas and move them off of a napkin into a solid 3D working model in a couple of days. And those three things were powerful, but we got into a lot of chalkboard sessions that how we could always make it better. And eventually, you know, sometimes you just have to say, hey, we can't continue to try to make it a little bit better. Let's get it out there and do surgery for a year and then get feedback from real world examples. So that's all. I mean, it was great. It's been an innovative culture here from the beginning. We just had to check ourselves a little bit.
And now we'll take a break from this conversation with Todd Pope to tell you about the MedTech Conference, which is happening again on May 31st in Minneapolis. We've got our breakout sessions all scheduled. They're on the agenda. They're selling out, at least filling up, I should say. They're free with admission to the MedTech Conference. So go to medtechconference.com, check out the many topics from our many great partners, and make sure you get in one of the remaining sessions. They're really a fantastic take, and you should hop on that right away. Of course, to do that, you need to register. So go to medtechconference.com. Take care of that if you haven't already done it, and then sign in your breakout session. Now let's get back into this conversation with Todd Pope. Let's focus then on the decision to incorporate robotics into what you're doing. I mean, that's a huge step, a very large transition. What was that decision-making process like? And was it as hard as I'm thinking it is? Maybe it was not.
No, it was a huge decision. You know, one other piece of the puzzle is after we raised our $20 million, we got FDA approval, we got CE mark approval for Spyder, and we were out doing cases. We then wanted to build out our commercial infrastructure, so we did a Series B in 2009. You talked about the economy being tough, and it was actually a $55 million Series B, which again was very eye-popping for a lot of people. But we again felt like we had a very viable path to be extremely successful company, and we didn't want to nickel and dime, you know, our raise. So we got our current investors came along, and we brought new investors, and we led a Series B, and that was very exciting. Along that time, after we closed that Series B, we started being approached by some of the larger companies, and you know, one of the robot companies, and said we'd be interested in if you might want to consider licensing some of your technology to us in the robotics field. We think your front end, your patient interfacing part of your product would be fantastic. So we started weighing the decision to do that, and it came evident to me that robotics was going to be a very fast-growing part of medtech. Now, at the time, that was still controversial because there's really just been one dominant player in robotics, and you got to think this was, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and at that time, I think the jury was still out in many people's mind how far robotics would go past prostate, because that's the only procedure that was really being done. But I really felt like we could actually become a player in robotics, even though we didn't have robotics core competency. We had all this feedback from the surgeons of how they wanted products interfacing with the patient. We were being very innovative, moving very quickly, and we constantly heard the same feedback from every robotic surgeon. There were 5 or 6 things that every robotic surgeon said, if the robot just did this, we would use it so much more. And so since that was so consistent, I went back to the board and said, let's take our product knowledge, our product that actually interfaces with the patient, instead of having it being just strictly mechanical, let's digitize it. Let's roboticize it. I think we can bring a lot of value to our product offering. And robotics is growing, and there's only one company out there, so let's do it. And I could just tell you, we don't have enough time on the blog today to discuss it, but that was a hotly contested decision because, you know, the board was venture capital backed. They had put a lot of money in the company. We had good momentum going with our, you know, mechanical product. And they said, look, let's just run the typical play. Let's go out there, drive sales, and try to bring value to our shareholders. And I said, well, I think we can play for a bigger outcome. And eventually the board agreed. I was really very appreciative and still am to this day that they were willing to take that chance, because what that meant was we were going to have to invest a lot more money and it was going to take a lot longer to get in the market. But we felt like that the payoff would be potentially much bigger.
So how did that, including that robotic element, introducing that robotic element, how did that change the company? I mean, you literally sound like you had almost a machine shop in there. You were making tools for surgeons and getting them out. But this brings in a whole different level of technology and know-how. So how did you go through that transition?
It really did. We had to sit back and say, what core competencies do we have today? What core competencies would be required, not only just to get into robotics, but be a leader in robotics? And, you know, for me, I've always been told by my mentors, you're going to have certain challenges in your business that there are probably people around the world that are, they're just global experts. And you know, you should not settle for anything less than that. So, you know, we started looking around. We tried to find who are the most respected people in the world around robotics and technology. One person's name that came up was Dean Kamen. Dean is very well known throughout the world. I contacted him. I asked him if I could come up and really pick his brain, learn from him. He helped us out early. We interviewed other, you know, CEOs of other robotics companies and industries outside of medical. There's a lot of robotic companies that build manufacturing robots, and a lot of high-tech roboticizing has been done that's outside of medical. So we went and met with a lot of those folks. Some of those are in Europe. Some of those are in Asia. And so we really scoured the globe, interviewed a lot of people, and they really helped me determine what type of people we needed. We needed electrical engineers. We need people that can take technology and miniaturize it. We need some folks that understand how you take those and get them sterilized in a medical environment. We really started what we felt like we were going to be building the dream team, but it was from scratch because we didn't have electrical engineers. We didn't have a software capability within the company. We had to go hire all that. We moved a lot of people from Silicon Valley out here to Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. And a lot of people said we should move the company out to the Bay Area at that point, where a lot of the, maybe the technologists were, but we decided not to. And we've been able to move a lot of people here. It's a wonderful place to live and grow a business. And so that's how we set off to do that.
And you were able to do that with your Series B money. The Series B round was the last round, private round that you raised, correct?
We were. And then, you know, as we were going through that Series B, you know, pretty aggressively, all the initiatives I just outlined, became apparent to me that to grow this company the way we needed to and to have the investment we needed to, it wouldn't be fair to ask the venture capital community to continue to do it, because we had already raised a tremendous amount of money for a VC-backed company, you know, a $20 million A round, a $55 million B round. So I made the decision that we were going to need to go public. And for a med tech company with no revenue, that is very daunting.
In 2013.
You can't do an IPO like you can in biotech.
Right.
Yeah. You just can't say, well, we're in a phase two on a cancer drug and it looks really promising and you can take that story to the street. But with the med tech that's still in development, thinking about going public, that most everyone just said you won't be able to do that.
But you found a way. You, in 2013, did the reverse merger with SafeSearch.
We did find a way. I would say that, yeah, the two challenges we had was, one, we had a venture capital board, and they're not, you know, typically their idea is not to go public because that typically makes everyone around the table common shareholders, and venture capitalists are preferred shareholders, and that's just not part of their business model. So we had a lot of convincing and cajoling to do around the board that was the best thing, but they eventually backed me and the team on that, and I was very appreciative. And then we had to figure out how to go public, and we did a reverse merger. We worked with a great company in Safe Stitch, and you know, a great business leader, Phil Frost, and then Jane Shao. Those are two people that we met. They'd had a lot of success with reverse mergers in the past, because not all reverse mergers typically work out well, but they had had a lot of success. They had a med tech company that was also in the minimally invasive realm, so we didn't merge into a shell. We merged into an actual company that had people working there, good technology. They were public, but felt like combining with us actually gave both companies a better chance to survive. So that's what we did. We merged the companies together. I remained the CEO of the combined company. We decided that we would need to uplist to either NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange so we could really get some of these long-only mutual funds to invest. They typically can't invest in an over-the-counter stock. So we met with both NASDAQ and the NYSE. They were very excited about the prospects of robotic surgery, and both exchanges felt like transenterics would be great there. So we weighed the options, and both were great. We decided to go to the New York Stock Exchange. And so we uplisted to the NYSE, you know, about 6 or 8 months after the reverse merger. And then we went out and started raising money as a public company. And by that time, we were headlong working on the Surgibot. And that was exciting times.
I mean, it does provide some, it's a great point about the VCs not wanting to do public, but on the other hand, some liquidity in this day and age isn't a bad thing. And I think they were, some at least were able to exit the company, or at least partially exit the company when they felt they needed to. So I'm sure that was appreciated.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think liquidity is a good thing. It's just when people say they want to go public, there's 10 or 12 daunting steps that you'd have to, you know, navigate to ever make it to where someone could become liquid. So, yeah, looking back on it, it was a good thing. But at the time, it certainly, you know, and think about it, they had invested a lot of money, and they were basically saying by going public and working on a robotic platform that they were pushing out their horizon another 2, 3, 4 years because they knew it was going to take a lot of development. But by this time, robotic surgery was more and more in the mainstream. Some of the larger players were starting to say they were going to get into robotics, and we weren't as much on an island. We all of a sudden started, people weren't looking at us like they were 8 years ago saying, is robotic surgery really where do you think you want to go? And now people were saying, you guys actually have a head start. That's fantastic. So, you know, it was exciting. We developed the product. We worked hard for a couple of years. We went to the FDA, and we had did a pre-submission meeting, sat down with them and said, you know, there's been a long time since you've approved a robot. What would you like to see? And so we started working with them on our submission, which is obviously important because we were no longer selling the Spider. We went 100% all in on developing the Surgibot. So we needed to get regulatory approval to take the next step.
Sure. And were you using Da Vinci as a predicate for the 510K?
Well, we partly, obviously, as a robotic platform, that was the only one approved, and certainly that was part of the comparison that the agency was making. But we also had some, you know, unique features that we were comparing to other things too. So it was a time where the FDA knew others would be coming down the road. They had a public forum to try to get feedback on how robotic assisted surgery devices should be viewed in the regulatory scope. So it was a time of, I think, learning for everyone, learning for the agency, learning for industry, learning for us. So, you know, we felt like we had good alignment. We were, you know, we were disappointed when they asked us for some more information at the time. You know, for a regular company that does a lot of submissions, that wouldn't have been a big deal to get a request, you know, to do a little more work. But since we had everything riding on that, that was challenging back, you know, in April of 16, when we got feedback from them that, you know, they weren't going to approve it at that time. They just wanted some more information. So that was challenging time for sure.
Well, let's talk a bit about the process and the news from the FDA. How long did that process take? How long were you engaged in? What ultimately led to their decision not to give you the notification that you needed?
Yeah, well, the backstory on that is we had worked for several years with the FDA on a pre-submission and preparing, you know, our filing and doing all the testing that's required for any, you know, medical device on a 510K. It's very rigorous what's required. And along those lines, you know, what an interesting, you know, an interesting part of our story is in 2015, we were just preparing to file with the FDA with Surgibot, and we were made aware of another platform that was over in Europe. Many of us in the industry had heard about this platform that had been worked on in somewhat secrecy because they had very good funding over there. So when you don't require funding, you don't need to be out in the press talking about all your progress. But we had heard a lot about this tremendous platform. It was called AlphaX at the time, you know, like Project X. We were actually contacted by the company that was developing the product back in 2015. They were very enamored with what we were doing. You know, one, because we were only doing robotic surgery. We were not a part of a huge company that it was just a small project. We were 100% dedicated to robotic surgery. That was very appealing to them. Two, we were kind of dedicated to laparoscopic surgeons and laparoscopic surgery movement. They felt like that was very different than the platform that was on the market today, and it was similar. The SurgiBot was going to be operating similar to their AlphaX. And then lastly, they knew we were public, and they felt like we would be able to raise the money to get the product all the way to market. So we actually got together with them to evaluate, would it make sense to acquire that product? Now, that was very challenging at the time because we had gone public. We had been totally dedicated to SurgiBot. We had raised a lot of money for SurgiBot, and we were getting ready to file with the FDA. So considering acquiring a product from Europe at that time was challenging, to say the least. But I'll just say that, you know, I went over with my team. We took surgeons. We all went over. We saw the product. We saw it in surgery, and we were absolutely blown away by it. We just felt like the platform was incredible. And we sat there in the summer of 2015. Other companies were looking at the product themselves to acquire, so we felt like we were a little bit of an underdog. But I just felt like that it would be the platform for robotic surgery for the next 10 years, and we were very excited about SurgiBot and felt good about it. But we felt like we needed to find a way to acquire that technology if we were going to really lead, you know, for the next 5 to 10 years in robotics.
So at the time, did you see Transenterics having two platforms, or was Senhance the definitely?
Yes.
Okay.
No, we were excited because SurgiBot was single port, and we were very excited about that. And, you know, the AlphaX, which now we call the Senhance, was multi-port. So we felt like they would both be very complementary to one another. So, you know, just to bring that to a head, you know, we decided that we wanted to acquire the AlphaX. We worked with the company. We did acquire that. That's all public. You know, it was a $100 million deal, part equity, part cash. And we acquired it. Again, you have to tip your hat to the board. They were very forward-thinking and allowing us to take yet another chance. You know, so we were excited. We had acquired the AlphaX by the end of the year, and we were very excited about our approval by SurgiBot, you know, early in the following year. So when we did get the news that they wanted, you know, some more information and, you know, it wasn't going to be approved, the SurgiBot, that is, at the time, the AlphaX, which now we call Senhance, it had a CE mark, and they were starting to do human cases. So we felt like we were going to put all of our attention on the Senhance at the time. And so we continued to gather clinical data in Europe since we had a CE mark. We worked with the FDA. We felt like we had learned a lot, and they knew a little bit more about what they wanted from a robotics company. So we really decided to put all of our efforts into Senhance, and that's kind of what we've been doing the last year and a half. We've started to roll it out more in Europe. We gathered a lot of clinical data, and then you know, last year we filed the Senhance with the FDA. We had a good amount of human clinical data, which is a little bit rare for a 510K. Most 510Ks don't have human clinical data, but we had it in Europe. It was good data. We turned it in, and we were very pleased with the agency. We worked very closely with them, and we received, you know, our approval 6 months later, and that was in October of 2017. So we've now continued to focus on rolling that product out in Europe, and now we're building a team here in the U.S., and I can honestly tell you that the whole world of, you know, surgeons and hospitals are so excited to have another platform on the market. All the things that we saw in the platform when we first looked at it, you know, surgeons are resonating with that. So, you know, 1999 is when the first robotic platform was out there and approved, and we're only the second one since then in kind of the soft tissue space. So, to say the least, it's been generating a lot of excitement, not only in Europe and in the U.S., but really around the world. You know, we're engaged in Asia and certainly all around the world. So it's been quite a journey from coming here and having an idea to push forward minimally invasive surgery and being a VC-backed company and having great venture capital partners, a great board. They were able to, really see the vision of what we could become. And we raised a lot of money from venture capital and we went public and we've had some good fundraising in the public realm and, all the ups and downs that come with all the things that we just described. But I think we're sitting here today in May of 2018. We're in a good spot. We're in a really good spot. We're still, what's amazing is when we started thinking about going into robotics, there's only one company out there. And here we are. Next month will be my 10th year anniversary of getting this company going. And we're still, we're the only other product on the market. Others are trying and get there, but all the things that we experience, all those challenges, they're going through now. And I just think we decided to run this race a lot earlier than most. So we've got a nice head start.
So, and I want to look ahead for one second, but you did sell the Surgibot system. Who did that go to? And do you what do you see for the future of that?
Yeah, when we were working with the Surgibot, we fully expected to get approval. And so we were lining up distributors around the world for it. And when we got the news, we were quite surprised. But some of our distributors said, look, I know you're going to be focusing on the Senhance. We love the Surgibot. You love the Surgibot. We think it has a great future. Would you consider selling it to us? We'll develop it and we'll still allow you to have rights to commercialize it. So we evaluated several of those partners. We ended up going with a large, healthy partner in China, a very large, partner over there that's very successful. It's been in the market for a long time. They acquired the rights to the Surgibot. They're actually going to manufacture it there in China and get regulatory approval. But we maintain the commercialization rights around the world for Surgibot and everything other than China. So it's a great opportunity for us. We've invested a lot of money in the Surgibot. We feel great about the future there. It's going to take a little while to get our manufacturing where we want it over there and get regulatory approvals. But right now we're, pretty much all out focused on the Senhance. It's got a great future. And then, over the years when the Surgibot's ready, I think that's going to be very additive for the company. And we were always excited about Surgibot and we remain excited about its future.
Well, yeah, what a ride. You're right. For 10 years ago, you were not planning to be a robotics, the king of robotics, but here you are. you've got one of the leaders
well,
in the space.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people all the time that most companies, they end up at a different place than where they started. But I think the thing that we always stayed true to is we wanted to make surgery better. We wanted to make surgery more cost effective. And we wanted to do that quickly and in a very innovative fashion. And you can apply those principles a couple different ways. But we've stayed with minimally invasive surgery. We certainly are bringing great robotic technology to the market. And we're super excited, we're an overnight success 10 years in the making.
I wish I could end on that, but I do want to understand just to talk about Senhance. I mean, where do you see yourself moving into many different specialties, into different parts of the body from here? What is Transenterics, this is the last question, what does Transenterics look like in 5 years? What kind of offerings do you have? What parts of what specialties are you in? What is Senhance doing?
Well, going back to that original comment when we decided to go into robotics, I said there was consistent feedback from surgeons, why is there still pretty small penetration of robotics into surgery today? And it was all based around, three components. First, people said, if you bring robotics into the OR, you can't slow us down. We need to keep our efficiency up. Time is money in the OR. So we've really worked hard to leverage the current skills and training that already exist in laparoscopic surgery and their staff. You can place your trocars in the same place with Senhance as you do laparoscopic surgery. You can use your same operating room beds. You can use your same trocars. All of that efficiency that exists today in laparoscopic surgery, we've been able to replicate it with the Senhance. So efficiency is number one. We solved that problem that robotics is not going to be slowing them down. Secondly, they wanted to maintain their minimally invasive surgery standards. Laparoscopists primarily use 5-millimeter trocars, so we built all of our instruments that are 5-millimeter. That's a big benefit over current robotics today. And we just got approved in Europe for 3-millimeter instruments. So we're going to continue to reduce the invasiveness of surgery, and that's fantastic. Surgeons wanted to have a sense of touch and feel. That's very important to surgeons. They haven't had it with robotics. We launched a Senhance with haptic feedback, which is a very, very exciting feature that we're offering. And then lastly, one thing that most people don't realize is there's not reimbursement codes for robotics. Robotic surgery uses laparoscopic reimbursement codes. So you can't charge, two, three, four times more than laparoscopic surgery because we're using laparoscopic reimbursement codes. So we have implemented more of a reusable surgery instruments like they do in laparoscopic surgery. So we've been able to take the cost of robotic surgery down dramatically. So efficiency, maintaining minimally invasive surgery standards, and offering responsible economics on the per procedure basis. That's what the tenets of the Senhance is. And to answer your question, we think those three pillars are going to, propel us into many different surgeries. You know, today our CE mark is for general surgery, GYN, urology, and thoracic. And we're going to be building toward a similar, a similar regulatory landscape, here in the States and around the world. So I think our platform has the, ability to go across many different specialties, many different surgeries, and bring all the benefits of robotics to patient care without a lot of incremental cost on a per procedure basis. So I think the future is bright, for Transenterix and for Senhance. We certainly need to go out and get it done. We remain humble but hungry.
Well, that is a great way to end it, and I appreciate your taking the time to share the story. It's I think truly a medtech story. I think you've had a taste of everything that a startup can taste, from raising rounds to pivoting to going public. So appreciate your taking the time to talk to us today, Todd.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thank you, MedTech Talk Podcast listeners, for joining us. It's a great pleasure to have you here. Appreciate it if you would subscribe if you haven't already. Give us a ranking on iTunes so we'll know how well we're doing or not doing, I suppose. And you could also do us a favor by telling your friends about the MedTech Talk Podcast. Also, don't forget, you can reach out to me. I'm on Twitter at MedTechTom. You can also reach me via email, tom@healthag.com. That's the word health, followed by letters EGY.com. HealthAG is the producer of many great events. We just had our Respiratory Innovation Summit a few days ago. We've got the MedTech Conference coming up on May 31st. I think I might have mentioned that once or twice. Don't forget to register for the MedTech Conference if you haven't done so already. And because you've listened to this entire podcast, I will tell you about the MedTech Talk code. Plug in the MedTech Talk code when you register, and you'll save yourself $100. That'll go a long way toward paying the room at the Lowe's Minneapolis Hotel. So we hope to see you there at the MedTech Conference, and tune in next week for another great tale of innovation on the MedTech Talk Podcast.